And we welcome you back once again to Recovery Coast to Coast, America's nightly voice for recovery. Great to have you with us tonight. We have a great show lined up. We're going to start off with Chris Campion. Now, Chris has been on the show before, way back in December of 2005 when Recovery Coast to Coast first hit the airwaves. At that time, Chris was starring in an off-Broadway play called Escape from Bellevue. Well, Chris now is the author of a book that talks about the struggles and the survival, which was chronicled in that successful off-Broadway play. He's turned it into a book published by Gotham. It is available at Amazon. He is also the frontman for the Knockout Drops, a New York-based indie band. Chris, welcome back to Recovery Coast to Coast after a long time.
Oh, it's good to be back, Neil. You know, I remember that interview back in December of 05, we had a lively good time that night. I think I just finished doing the show when we talked that time.
You did indeed.
And then
And then following that, a few nights later, I was in New York City and had a chance to see the play, which I absolutely loved, just before it closed, as a matter of fact.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. That was a good time that night.
It was really fun.
It was fun to meet you there, too, after speaking to you on the phone. And there was something really, I just loved the interview we did on the radio then, only because, you know, I'm still a night owl. You know, that's not something that changed, you know, when I got sober. I'm still awake. I'm still one of these, like, climb-the-walls types, you know, and thought that was the perfect time for that interview, you know, because seems like my brain is still most active between midnight and 4 a.m. So.
The book just came out. It's called Escape from Bellevue, A Dive Bar Odyssey, and it is published by the good folks at Gotham Books. And it starts
They're an imprint of Penguin Publishers. So you can get it in any bookstore, too, Barnes & Noble or whatever.
Or if you want to go online, you can find it at Amazon.com as well.
Yeah. I find that's the best way to do it.
Absolutely. But. Chris, you grew up in an Irish Catholic family. The book, which is hilarious in a strange sort of way, and I guess everyone can look back at their drinking and using days now in recovery and laugh at a lot of the things that happened, but when it was happening, it wasn't all that funny. You start off with a very hilarious story about barfing when you were about to receive your first communion.
It is just
hilarious. I was on the bus reading this, and people probably thought I needed to be in Bellevue because I kept breaking out of the laughter. Tell that story, if you would.
Well, it's interesting. When I went to go write the book, I was, you know, I live in New York City, and it's a very frenetic environment, and, you know, still doing gigs with the band and everything, and I kind of had to close down our schedule for a while to sequester myself and write this book, you know. And so I ended up, one of the producers on the Bellevue show had a house out in Amagansett, which is on the eastern tip of Long Island near Montauk, very desolate area. In the wintertime, so I went out there, and I was trying to think, you know, of all these great lines that have opened up, you know, famous books that I love, and, you know, I was thinking Tale of Two Cities, it was the best of times, it was the worst of times, Now is the winter of our discontent. So I was like, I need a great opening line, so mine was, I puked at my first Holy Communion.
That's a good one.
That breaks the ground on the book. But, essentially what happened was I was in, as you said, grew up in an Irish Catholic family, six kids, and, it was the night before, the eve of my first Holy Communion, and, you know, my mom came into the room, and she said something like, get a lot of sleep, you know, tomorrow's a big day, you're going to be receiving Jesus for the first time, and that means he's going to be alive in you. And she flicked off the light and leaving me there in my 8-year-old sort of psychosis as to what that meant.
Wow.
He's going to be alive in you. And I was struggling with this theology. And my brother, Bobby, who at the time was like 17 years old, he was a teenager. He was singing in bands already. And earlier that evening, I'd been listening to his band play at a lawn party just a couple of houses away. And they were playing like Bertha by the Grateful Dead, and I heard the tune wafting in the window, so later that night, he appeared in my window because he was sneaking into the house, and he kind of rapped on the window, and I had to let him in. You know, while I had him there, I knew that he'd been getting communion for years, and I said, you know, Bob, what does Mom mean that, you know, tomorrow I'm going to be receiving Jesus, he's going to be alive in me. What does that mean? You know, he kind of looked at me deadpan and just said, it just means for the first time you'll be eating his flesh. And then kind of left out of the room. very succinct explanation. So I think that gave way to a night of insomnia, and lo and behold, the next day I woke up and my stomach was in ruins and ants in my pants and piranhas in my stomach. And when it came time to actually get the communion, it was already a pretty big melee in the church, because I ended up throwing up prior to going up online to receive communion. Then, you know, I was kind of fighting it off on the way up to the altar, and the priest, you know, raised the host in front of me, and I thought it was going to happen again. You know, he said, "Body of Christ," and I, there it was again. I thought I was going to puke all over his beautiful vestiges, and out came a burp. He said, "Amen, indeed, Christopher." And from that point on, I was a believer.
And that's the start of the book, and it goes on, and we're introduced to a lot of characters, a lot of friends of yours. You use the term vicious freaks as a term really of endearment for a lot of your friends. Explain that.
Well, vicious freaks is kind of, that's just a pet name I have for anybody that's like a misfit or sort of living out there left of the dial and cutting their own swath through this world. And you know, when you play in a rock and roll band, you encounter these characters. You know, rock and roll takes you to a lot of strange corners of the earth. And, I mean, the book itself, you know, when I was interviewing with you back in December of 05, I mean, the book, the show is called Escape from Bellevue, but the book is called Escape from Bellevue, A Dive Bar Odyssey. You know, I think part of the odyssey is these colorful characters along the way.
Oh, yeah.
We had a guy in our town, I guess the very first one that made an impression on me was a guy named Walking Willie, who appeared on the scene when the Sony Walkman came out back in the early 80s. This guy had one of these sort of mad scientist looks to him. He would bop around town, dancing in the streets. He would stop in the middle of crosswalks. When people would beep their horns, it would activate some kind of electric boogaloo dance in him. And he would start, and then he would do this little routine in front of your car. Cherry on top of that routine would be that he would start humping the bumper of your car. So I would categorize Walking Willie as he was like a beloved figure in our town, Huntington, Long Island. So I would describe him as the quintessential vicious freak. And then, you know, other people, like, you know, especially when I moved into New York, there was a guy in my corner that had a one-man band, you know, with the bass drum and the horn connected to it, and, you know, would play his tunes on the corner and busk for a change. And, you know, and it's just, that's kind of how I refer to all these type characters.
Talk about your love affair with Lady Alcohol, what she did to you, Chris, and what happened.
Growing up in a family of drinkers, you know, you really can't swing a dead cat without hitting an alcoholic.
You find four Irish Catholics, you always find a fifth, too.
Yeah. Wow, I hadn't heard that one. I'm gonna keep that one on file. That's a good one. Being raised as I was, you know, it was a household that I think growing up Campion, we were either getting ready for, cleaning up from, or smack dab in the middle of a raging party. And it was fun, you know. I mean, it was lots of music, people singing, and everything like that. And that was kind of the lighter side of alcoholism, I guess, to use an odd turn of phrase. You know, so for me, when I started drinking when I was about 14, you know, I'd kind of already bought into the mythology of sort of drinking and what it can do for you. And all my heroes, people like Jim Morrison or Jack Kerouac or whoever it might be, were alcoholics, you know, and drug addicts. And so I think somewhere in that, I had put together that I guess if you're going to be a great artist or in my case, you know, front a rock and roll band, that it just goes part and parcel with that. You know, I kind of used that, kind of bit down on the chum of that and kind of let it take me for the ride that it did, you know, and when it went south on me, because it's progressive disease, you know, I kind of didn't know what to do because it had been my life up to that point. I mean, I never could imagine, couldn't even fathom what it would be like not to drink. And I was just really fearful of what I'd be like on the other side of that corridor, a sober guy. You know, and that almost killed me, hanging on to that idea. And it gave way to lots of denial, and, you know, you're soldiering through all these disasters, which are graphically mapped out in the book. You're kind of doing it in a way like you just don't know that there's another way. Despite the fact that I'd been exposed to recovery, you know, my dad had gotten sober when I was 17 after his alcoholic story and growing up with him as an active alcoholic. But it's funny, you know, once you take that first drink, knowledge is not the thing that is going to get you sober. I mean, knowledge of the disease of alcoholism isn't going to really help you when you're drinking.
Absolutely. Chris Campion is joining us tonight. He is the author of the book Escape from Bellevue, A Dive Bar Odyssey. You talked about your dad, and I know that in the book you talk about the intervention that was done on you, but you were involved in the intervention that was done on your dad.
Yes, yes. Well, in my family, we call interventions surprise parties. Because there's been so many we kind of look at his like it's like the sort of we look back on his, which took place in 1980. We look back on that kind of like people look back on the First Continental Congress or something with great reverence, you know, because I think that the recovery industry at that point in time was, you know, is very much in the pioneer stage, interventions, rehabs, what have you. You know, we ended up getting hooked up with a place called the Freedom Institute through my mom kind of handled this through the church.
I remember the Freedom Institute. It was run by a gal named Mona Mansell, as a matter of
fact. She's in the book, and she's a fantastic lady.
Yeah.
Really changed the trajectory of our entire family, which, I mean, really saved our family. She was she was a spark plug of a gal, and, you know, we knew nothing, you know, and like a lot of other people at that time knew nothing about, you know, how to do an intervention or get someone sober, or it's not the commonplace thing, or it wasn't then the commonplace thing that it is now, but we managed to get my dad, we would go into the city and we would talk to Mona and she would instruct us on how to do this intervention, which, you know, is the basic format of going around the room, getting the person there first off, which we had to get my dad there under the guise of, I think he thought he was going to be meeting with a priest, who's a guy named Peter Schweizgood, who...
I knew Peter very well.
You knew Peter, and he was an incredible guy, and he was also part of this intervention. Well, as you know Peter, you're going to love this story.
Yeah.
My dad had known Peter through my Aunt Mary, who was also associated with Freedom Institute, Mary Condon. So my dad had a lot of respect for Peter Schweizgood. He was kind of like one of these priests. I think he played football for Fordham when he was, you know, in his college days. He was very, very charismatic guy and a big, big guy. And so my dad had a lot of, got along really well with him. He was the only priest I ever saw who jumped into like a convertible sports car. And like, he did, right? Do you remember that?
Yeah, I do.
Really, guy had a lot of pizzazz, you know. Anyway, so he was responsible for getting my dad to the intervention under the guise of some kind of marriage counseling with my mom. So there we were, you know, my dad comes walking into this room. He sees everybody sitting around. He knows that he's been led into this ambush. And he says, no way, no way. He's like, I was not consulted here. I'm not going to do this. And he turns around and Father Peter was saying, listen, Bob, just hear everybody out. You know, they're here they love you. They just want to say their piece. And he said, I wasn't consulted. So they started tussling. So this is how the intervention, they start tussling. I think one of them tripped over like a chair leg. Oh. And they ended up on the floor wrestling around in the middle of this semicircle of people that are waiting to speak to my dad, you know, in the intervention. And all of a sudden there's this WWF type situation going on, you know, WrestleMania. As they're rolling on the floor, my dad's saying, you know, hey, Pete, what do you say? I kick your ass. And then afterwards, you could hear my confession. And to which Father Pete responded, or Bob, I could kick your ass and we could just call it your confession.
Great line.
Yeah, so that's how that started. And we did eventually get him seated and do the intervention, which is, you know, I go into in the book, which is pretty heavy, but like you said, you know, now with enough distance, we can look through the prism of humor and, you know, which is what happens when alcoholics get together and share and tell their stories and connect with each other. As you know, there's a lot of laughing going on in those rooms.
Chris, I want to, first of all, talk again about intervention. In the last segment, we talked about your dad's intervention.
Right.
Your girlfriend, Gracie, was involved with an intervention for you with you and probably 30 of your closest friends at the time.
And, sure, yeah.
And again, the tables were turned, and suddenly the intervention is all about you.
I guess in the book, the interesting thing is during my intervention, I kind of floated into this recollection of my dad's intervention, which we just talked about. And, you know, I'd love to say that that was my only intervention. I think that there were two.
Mm-hmm.
Got to check my records on that.
Yeah.
This was the one that didn't take. And it's interesting with interventions. I've been involved with successful ones where, you know, the person went right into a car and was taken to rehab and that it had a lot of impact right in the moment. But sometimes, you know, an intervention really is just going to plant the seed for, you know, a recovery to blossom later. And that's kind of what happened with me. It's like I was there, and I could hear everybody tossing their two cents in and pleading with me to get sober and stop making them so afraid
mm-hmm.
for me and afraid, you know, and everything like that. And it's like when you're, you know, in the throes of alcoholism and addiction, like, it's just such a self-centered disease. So it's like I, my heart was melting as I was hearing people make these pleas, but at the same time, I knew that I wasn't done, you know, and I actually remember thanking everybody as they were leaving and saying how much it meant to me that they were there and everything, but I also knew that I wasn't finished. That's a scary thing, but the hopeful thing, I think, in terms of intervention is that when I did run out of road, you know, when I did have that moment of clarity, the intervention was in the forefront of all that. Like, it was there. You know, I thought of all the people that had been reaching out to me and you know, I didn't want to let people down anymore, and I didn't want to let myself down anymore. And so sometimes, you know, it's a time release thing with an intervention, you know, it might not work until the following month or the following year or 2 years, but I still think it's a worthwhile endeavor, you know.
It certainly lays the groundwork, sure.
One of the best things that we have available to us to get a person to stop killing themselves with drugs and alcohol, because, you know, I mean, if somebody doesn't intervene and at least, you know, because alcoholics and drug addicts, I know myself, I was always one or two chess moves ahead of everybody.
Yeah.
You know, or so I thought. You know, you know what I mean? And, you know, when you just let that kind of behavior go on and play along with it, it only feeds the disease. So we got to let people know that it's not okay that they're killing themselves, and it's not okay with you that they're killing themselves. And what ended up happening with me is my family, I became persona non grata, and that was enough. I didn't want to be persona non grata, you know. I love my family.
Interventions are important because, you know, I don't know very many people who wake up on a bright, sunny day and say, you know, I think I'm going to do something about my drinking today.
Yeah,
it just doesn't work that way.
Yeah, in the wake of some great success.
Yeah.
You know what? I think I'm drinking too much. That's really not how it goes.
I've never heard that story before. Chris Campion.
Never heard. I'm still waiting to hear that one, too.
Escape from Bellevue is the name of the book. Yeah, you know, alcoholics and addicts are great cons, and you certainly took that to a whole new level in the book. And really, the story of the escape is only about four or five pages, but they are absolutely magnificent. Talking about the escape, it was classic. From the point where they were taking you in the ambulance and you were kind of, you know, chatting up the people and talking the man talk and doing the whole thing. Talk about what happened when you got in there and the guy that was your ticket out.
Okay, well, now, remember, Neil, I don't want to give too much away this is, people do have to get this thing. They have to go to their local Barnes & Noble or get it online and find out.
There's really so much, I guess what I'm trying to say is there's so much more to it than just the escape.
Absolutely. Yeah, the escape, I think, obviously that's, the pinnacle, and it's a big part of the story, the arc, the actual escape from Bellevue. But yeah, I'd already been to Bellevue. I went to Bellevue three times between the years 1998 and 2000. Well, two and a half if you count my escape.
Yeah.
But I already had the lay of the land.
Yeah.
Because I had been taken to Bellevue, and the reason being is that I would go into the nether regions of my psyche after, you know, a heroic amount of drinking and drugging. And I was going into the suicidal diatribes, sort of almost like this other voice, this other character had appeared, kind of a Jekyll and Hyde thing, where I would go into these blackouts and, you know, all the pain that would come out and the self-loathing and everything else. And so for a long time, I was saying to my friends, to people around, I was saying, oh, I might just kill myself, and never remembering it. But the first time, you know, at one point, I remember my girlfriend at the time, Gracie, who she'd got me on tape with a dictaphone, giving the walls a talking with all this, you know, stuff that I was saying. And I remember when she played me the tape, I mean, it sounded like my voice was like four octaves lower than my actual voice. You know, it sounded like Satan dictating his grievances, you know, with the world or something. I was like, that thing needs batteries. She was like, no, it's not batteries. It's you. So anyway, so I'd already been to Bellevue once because she'd gotten, or my roommates at the time, not even her, my roommates at the time had gotten scared and called them because I had said that I was going to off myself. And so that whole episode, you know, had already happened, and I had the lay of the land. So when I went to Bellevue the second time, which was the time I escaped, I kind of knew the ins and outs, you know. And so I got into the ambulance with the EMTs, and I said to them, guys, I mean, you know, women, I mean, she was just trying to appeal to them. They were a bunch of married guys, you know. I was like, she was just getting overly dramatic, you know. Just, no offense to women. I was just using that as a using that as just some kind of ploy, you know. And so these guys were like, yeah, we know. And just trying to friend them so that, you know, when it was time to make a break for it, they, you know, they wouldn't keep the cuffs on me and all that. And they didn't. First time I went there, you know, I went in handcuffs. Mm-hmm. And, but they thought I was a nice guy and I was completely playing them. And then, you know, I got into the hospital and I heard this fella down the hall. First what sounded like a velociraptor. Guy's like, man, I don't know if I can curse. I guess I can't curse on the radio here, right? Well, he was letting the expletives fly.
Yeah.
And you know, and he was making this noise like, I went in there and I asked him, you know, what he was doing there, and he was cocked out of his mind. So I kind of used him in my slapstick escape.
And let's leave it.
And
there.
I'll leave it there because I don't want to go too far.
We'll leave it there. When you read the book, you will meet Uncle Ernie, and that's about as much as I can say. We're going to take another break. Talk about hitting the bottom, Chris, and then what happened to start your road to recovery.
I lived in my bottom for way too long, soldiering through disasters, interventions, you know, relationships that were, you know, I mean, it's just a cyclone, as everyone who's in recovery knows, you know, when they look back at their story. You know, it's kind of like after escaping from Bellevue, I remember actually having the thought, like, what have I escaped to?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, there was no freedom in the life I was returning to. It was slavery, you know, in a sense. Wake up, you know, have to drink right away. You know, I could no longer stand myself.
You considered suicide too.
Yes, I did. And you know, along the way, I'd really lost my faith. You know, there's an experience that I describe in the book where my folks are taking me to college when I'm 18, and, you know, grew up Catholic, as we said, and really, you know, had a very, what I thought was a very intimate relationship with God as a child, you know, and kind of like the only one you really get to have, you know, as a childlike. So I had this experience where faith kind of flew out the window on the Jersey Turnpike on the way down to college. And it was just this free fall. You know, I've heard people say, like, alcoholism, drug addiction is a low bottom search for God. And I agree with that. I agree with that statement. And I feel like that was kind of the quest I was on. And so what happened at the end, you know, was basically, you know, there's a chapter in the book called The Triangle Trade of Misery, I call it.
Nice.
And I was kind of down to three bars. that, you know, one of them that I played, or two of them that I played in, because, you know, I could work an angle there because I played music in there so I could get free drinks. I was penniless at this point, couch surfing. I was homeless, didn't even really know that, you know, kind of, you know, when I still had a place to crash, like on somebody's couch, you kind of don't know that you're homeless, you know, when you're in that kind of steeped in that kind of denial. So for me, it was kind of like I'd always played off my drinking as, you know, I can remember as early on as my first blackout when, you know, I came home from a party and as a teenager, you know, I went to bed and then I got up and I was completely naked and I climbed in bed with my parents, which I think would take a legion of psychotherapists. But I remember telling that story. That was like something that really shook me.
Yeah.
But I remember I got on the phone with my best friend the next day, and I told him what happened, and I heard the phone hit the linoleum floor in his kitchen, and all I could hear was him cackling. And I kind of had gotten it into my head that if I could make all of this somehow funny, that it was okay. You know, that I was okay, that people liked me, and that it was okay to drink myself into a stupor. You know, because that's just how I was. And what happened was I was, you know, going to one of these three bars and I had a friend that owned one of the bars and he was very concerned about me. And I went in there just looking tattered and after a 3-day tear of just foodless drinking and drugging and just looking like, you know, death warmed over. And I tried to get his attention. There's this place called the Blind Tiger Ale House and he wouldn't serve me. He was like, he would only serve me water. And then I started sneaking drinks through this elaborate underground railroad of enablers in the bar. And, you know, he kind of caught on to that. And then, you know, he just said, I can't take this anymore. You know, and it's kind of like one of those moments where the music stopped and I was standing on a stool trying to get his attention and everybody looked up at me and I just saw the faces in the crowd and they were just looking at me with total pity and disgust, you know, and it was in that moment I realized I wasn't funny anymore. And that was a shock, you know, that was sent me into a real panic because, you know, it was just, I couldn't lie to myself anymore. I couldn't, you know, say this thing like, well, I'm entertaining people and it doesn't matter that I'm drunk and, you know, I had gotten to a point where every time I walked into a room, people were bristling, and who the hell wants to be that? And it was in that moment that I knew, you know, the end was near. So, I mean, I don't want to give too much away, because now we are sort of entering endgame here, and that's the ending of the book, and I'll just let people
find out. And really the beginning of your life in recovery. And
absolutely, yes.
How are things today for you, Chris?
Oh, it's, as they say, beyond my wildest dreams, which is a phrase that as a newcomer to sobriety, you know, I was here and I thought it was kind of hokey, like a lot of other sort of slogans and stuff like that. And it's really interesting how these like slogans that I thought were corny then are applicable now and I no longer find them corny. But, you know, I couldn't have dreamt up anything back when I was, you know, what I'm doing right now is just, you know, using the gifts that God gave me. God gave us all gifts, you know. And I don't think when I was drunk and drugged up that, you know, my life now is kind of like what I would tell people my life then, you know. I was the kind of guy that would tell you that I was doing all these great things, but I wasn't doing any of them. You know, I would just lie to you to bolster my own self-esteem, even for that moment. And that's, you know, that's kind of like, kind of how it is for me now.
You still play music, Chris?
What's that? Oh yeah, yeah. We're touring around, Knockout Drops. You know, we just played a huge show Friday, sold out show here in New York at a place called 92Y.
Great.
And it's just an amazing life, you know.
How long have you been in long-term recovery?
8 years.
8 years. And yeah. Obviously a day at a time. And, you know, you talked
all
about,
day at a time.
You talked about alcoholism being progressive. Certainly in a negative sense, it is progressive. But recovery is, in a positive sense, progressive as well. It does get
absolutely. You know, and it gets better I'll tell you, you know, somebody told me early on in recovery, like, it's esteemable acts, you know, and those are the building blocks, you know. So I feel like when you turn around somebody else, like you're doing now with this great radio show, which I'm thrilled, you know, I came on here, I guess now 4 years, you know,
almost
three and a half
years ago,
and you guys were starting up, and here you are, you know, almost 4 years later, just succeeding with this and bringing the message out there. And I feel like that's the key, you know. You know, it's a very self-centered disease, as you know, and it's also the engine is self-centered fear. And I think what eradicates self-centered fear is helping somebody else, because it gets you out of yourself and you feel great that you're doing that. That's like the key to me, you know. And the other thing is just connecting with other alcoholics and addicts. I, you know, I had a very askew vision of what recovery was when I was still in my cups, you know.
Sure.
I didn't want anything to do with it. I, you know, I'd heard that, you know, I thought it was like emotionalism and people spilling their guts in meetings and furling their personal stuff in front of other people, and I wanted nothing to do with that. You know, I wanted to keep everything a secret, you know. But I was in rehab, and this is how I really, and this is important for me to say this. This is in the book, but I will say this. I was in rehab, and I was in with a guy that was a drug kingpin, a drug dealing kingpin from the Bronx. He looked across at my bunk, and it was, we were both had just been admitted, and he looked at me.
I lost you there.
And I'm just this kid from the suburbs who grew up playing wiffle ball, you know. What I thought was nothing in common with this guy. And I said, so where are you from? And he was this Hispanic guy from the Bronx, and he comes running over, and he's like, do you want to know where I'm from? I'll show you where I'm from. And he pulls off his shirt, and he's got this constellation of gunshot wounds on his back, right? And so I rolled up my pant leg, and I said, you see right here? I said, 16 stitches, you know. I fell off my bike, and that kind of got his attention, and I could see that he was like a Harley guy, you know.
Mm-hmm.
He said, what kind of bike? You got a Harley? I said, no, a Schwinn. And that guy became my best friend in that rehab.
Was that at Arms Acres?
Yes, Arms Acres. And we were from completely different backgrounds, and you know what? We were exactly the same.
Absolutely.
And because we both wanted to get sober, and he had a deep affection for his family, as did I. And we'd heard a lot of people in our drinking and drugging, and that's where I saw the beauty in recovery. That's where it's just one person helping another person out, or it's two people banding together to get through something. You know, wherever two or more are gathered, right?
Absolutely.
And I just think that it's an amazing thing. You know, I have friends that are dry, that don't go to meetings, and you know what? To each his own. I really don't judge anyone, you know. But I think that you're really missing out if you don't get into a room full of people and mix it up and help each other out, because it's a beautiful thing, and it's a lot of laughs too.
Chris, nice catching up with you again. I wish you continued success. One day at a time, one gig at a time, one book at a time.
Absolutely, Neil. It's been a pleasure coming on here in any time. And best of luck with this. I'm sure it's just going to keep growing and growing and growing, and I'm certain of it.